Welcome to the Lawyer Education Series. My name is Katie Kelso and I am the Solicitor in Charge of Care and Protection at Legal Aid New South Wales. Before we get started today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that I am on, land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to Elders past and present. I also acknowledge the traditional owners of the land from which you are listening today. Today, I'm really lucky to be joined by Karen Shea, barrister at Frederick Jordan Chambers. Karen regularly appears in care matters in the Children's Court, the District Court, the Supreme Court, and she appears for the Secretary, for children, for parents, and other people that are involved in care proceedings. Welcome, Karen, and thanks for joining me to talk about evidence and advocacy basics.
Thank you for having me, Katie.
We're going to cover this topic because for most lawyers that are going to be on our panels, there's going to be a lot of advocacy work that they are potentially going to do themselves, from running interim hearings all the way through to running final hearings, conducting cross-examination, preparing submissions, delivering submissions, you name it. It's a big brief. There's a lot to think about. I want to just start by talking about Section 93 because I think that is a good place to start when we're talking about how things sort of go in the care and protection jurisdiction.
It is a good place to start, and it doesn't hurt to remind ourselves of what the general nature of the proceedings in the Children's Court is meant to be. So Section 93 tells us, firstly, that proceedings in the Children's Court are not to be conducted in an adversarial manner. They are to be conducted with as little formality and legal technicality and form as the circumstances permit. And importantly, the section says that the Children's Court is not bound by the rules of evidence unless the court, in a particular case, determines that the rules or parts of the rules are to be applied. Section 93 also reminds us that the standard of proof in proceedings is the balance of probabilities. Those are important, hallmarks of the way in which the Children's Court conducts these sorts of proceedings.
And just thinking that through, though, just because the rules of evidence don't apply doesn't mean it's a free-for-all, does it? We still need to be careful about the way that we present evidence. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think the bit that says as little formality and little technicality and form as the circumstances permit is also a little bit dangerous because we don't throw out our law degrees in the Children's Court and we don't forget that we are lawyers. And similarly with subsection 3, which talks about the rules of evidence not applying, it certainly doesn't mean it's a free-for-all. In my view, we should always strive to have the best evidence before the court because the better the evidence, the stronger your case.
Can you give an example of something like that, where there might be a few different ways that you can put a certain piece of evidence before the court, but there's perhaps a source that might be the best evidence for the court?
Well, I guess a fairly common example that comes to mind is if you're acting for a parent in a case where there are allegations of drug and alcohol abuse, and your client says that they've been having they've been addressing those issues by having drug and alcohol counselling, of course, the client themselves can give some evidence about what that counselling involves and how that counselling has benefited them. But the better evidence, the better evidence would be for that evidence to come from the counsellor, and to actually get a report or at least a letter from the counsellor that talks about their engagement with the client, the sorts of issues that have been addressed, the progress that's been made, and any recommendations for ongoing treatment.
That would be the better
evidence.
And obviously that would mean that evidence can also be tested by the court as well, which is really important. That person will then potentially be available for cross-examination. And certainly if you're thinking about the best way to run your client's case and to put their best foot forward, that's going to be the way that they're able to do that, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, the better the evidence, the better the quality of the evidence and the more admissible the evidence, the more weight it'll be given. And the more weight it's given, the more the more support it gives to your client's case. So yes, it ultimately assists your client's case to have the best evidence before the court.
So Karen, I'm just going to pick up on something that you just said, because I think it flows into the next point. It's still important that when we're thinking about the evidence that we might file in these proceedings, it's still important to focus on things like relevance and other sort of principles along those lines, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, even though subsection 3 says that the court is not bound by rules of evidence, again, we are lawyers and we have an obligation to conduct our client's case in a lawyerly fashion, and that includes ensuring that the evidence that we place before the court in affidavit material and the way that we conduct cross-examination and is relevant, right? That we still apply the rule in relation to relevance, even if it's strictly speaking the court's not bound by it. So we still need to make sure that the evidence in our client's affidavits is relevant to the issues in dispute. We still need to make sure that witnesses we call in support of our client's case give relevant evidence, and they're not just there to be cheerleaders or to waste the court's time, really. And it flows on to cross-examination, that when we cross-examine witnesses, we ask relevant questions. So that's all part and parcel of, doing things properly, even though the Act allows us to be less formal and less bound by technicality.
And just as a practical example, I'm sure that we've all been in situations where we've done some cross-examination on a topic that the court has not thought was relevant and been told very, very swiftly to move along. So, you certainly do see it in practice. I'm interested though, Karen, in having a think about when, if you're either acting for parents or even for children, when you might have to think about making an application for the Evidence Act or part of the rules of evidence, when you might need to think about making that application for them to apply.
I haven't seen it done often, to be honest, but where I have seen it done has been in cases involving allegations of sexual abuse, serious allegations of sexual abuse, because firstly, the nature of those allegations is so serious, and secondly, the consequences that flow from a court's decision, one way or another, are serious. So that's where it would pop up for me, particularly if I was acting for the alleged perpetrator of the abuse. I would consider making an application for the rules to apply, at least in relation to the evidence that relates to the allegations of sexual abuse.
And I think that ties in, and it's something that we've spoken about in another podcast that we've recorded, ties in with the cases like Ree Sophie and thinking through Brigginshaw and those types of cases in terms of the court needing to be satisfied to a particular level, factoring in the seriousness of the allegations. So that's
right. So in order to ensure that the appropriate standard is applied, and that your client, particularly if you're acting for the alleged perpetrator, is not findings are not made against your client on the basis of inadequate evidence, applying for the rules of evidence to apply is I think important.
So is it right to say that practitioners should be turning their minds to that issue quite early in proceedings, and having a look at each matter that they've got and the particular circumstances of that matter and making a decision about that quite early?
Yes, because the earlier that application is made, the better. Because if everyone knows early on that the rules of evidence are going to apply to this particular aspect of the case, then the evidence can be prepared accordingly. It's too late to apply at the final hearing, because all the evidence will be in and everyone will have prepared on the basis that the rules of evidence don't apply, and that would cause significant delay and complications if the rules were then subsequently applied at the trial. That would not be good for anybody.
No, I don't imagine you'd have a very impressed magistrate or judge either.
No, that's right.
I think that actually ties in quite nicely with the next question, which is all about case theory, because I imagine that is probably one aspect that you'll think about in the context of case theory. Karen, in your experience, when is the best time to start working on your case theory in a matter that you've got?
As early as possible. Right from the start, you should be thinking about it, because case theory is essentially two questions. What do you want, or what does your client want the court to do, and why should the court do it? Those are the two questions, and the answer to those questions is your case theory. And you've got to start thinking about that from the very start, because you certainly must have some idea of the answers to those questions before you start drafting an affidavit. Because if you don't know what the client wants or wants the court to do, or more importantly, why the court should do it, then it's very hard to know what evidence you need to put in your client's affidavit, because the evidence is what supports the why should you get it part, right? The second limb, if you like, it's a case theory. The answer to the question, why should your client get it, why should they get the outcome that they want, a sentence that begins with the word because, right? Because A, B, C, whatever the reasons are. The reasons A, B, C need to be supported by the evidence. And part of that evidence comes from your client's own material. So you need to know, in other words, you need to know where you're heading before you can start drafting.
And do you think that's relevant advice even when you're acting for children? I mean, it may be that you're a little bit more flexible, a little bit more open to the evidence that's coming in as it's coming in. Mm-hmm. But is it relevant to child representatives as well?
Well, it's relevant in the sense that you need to be thinking early on about what evidence is required in the case. And that's part of your obligations as an independent representative to ensure that all relevant evidence is before the court. So you've got to turn your mind early to what evidence might be required, particularly in the form of subpoena material, for example, or in the form of expert evidence. And so turning your mind to maybe not so much what do you want and why should you get it, but more, I suppose, the issues in the case and what the court may or may not require to determine those issues will inform you as to what evidence is required. So it's a bit of a different approach for an independent representative, although by the time you get to a final hearing as an independent representative, you should have some view. You should have at least a preliminary view, and you should have in mind what the reasons are in support of that view. So you should have a case theory of sorts, because that will then inform how you go about cross-examining and running the hearing.
And the case theory that you might develop early on in a matter is not necessarily the case theory you might end up running with at a final hearing, because sometimes matters start out in a particular way and where you started is not where you end up. Is it something where you would suggest to practitioners that they're constantly sort of revising their case theory and rethinking it and making sure it still works for their case?
That's right. You've got to be flexible. I mean, the evidence, the nature of these proceedings is that they go for some time. The evidence comes in often in dribs and drabs, and you've got to keep your mind open and your case theory flexible to take into account changes in the evidence. And sometimes issues that were issues in the beginning are not so important by the time you get to final hearing.
And an example of that might be, say, for example, you're acting as an ILR and one of, there's a few issues as to why the children were removed, but perhaps the parents have taken have made a lot of progress in relation to addressing one issue, but your case theory might be that that's all well and good and that's under control, but there's still a number of other things that are not addressed and therefore you wouldn't support restoration.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So that's right. And so your case theory changes. Initially, your case theory might be there is no realistic possibility of restoration because the parents have difficulties with drug and alcohol abuse. There are issues of family violence and they're homeless, right? So you might have three reasons why there should be a finding of no realistic possibility of restoration. During the course of the proceedings, the parents might address their homelessness. And so that limb of your case theory might no longer be relevant, and you'd then focus on the first two.
And then it's about turning your mind, isn't it, to once that third limb disappears, mm-hmm. whether those other two limbs are sufficient for you to still say that restoration should or shouldn't happen, isn't
That's
it?
Right.
So it's a constant readjustment and thinking about it again in the context of what's happening in the matter.
Yep. And that's where you then look at those two limbs, the drug and alcohol abuse and the domestic violence, and you look at the evidence in support of each of those limbs. And is it sufficient to come to the conclusion, or for the court to come to the conclusion, that there is no realistic possibility of restoration?
Mm. So just turning to case theory in the context of a final hearing, having a really clear case theory at a final hearing can be helpful for multiple reasons, can't it, Karen?
Yeah, you've got to have. I think you've got to have a case theory by the time you get to a final hearing, because otherwise, how do you know how to conduct the hearing? How do you know where you are going with your cross-examination, for example? Cross-examination that is conducted without a purpose or without a direction is dangerous. And so in order to have a direction or a purpose for your cross-examination, you need to know or have a pretty good idea of where you're going to land, right? What you're going to say at the end of the day, to the court in your submissions, which is why you always hear advocates say that you begin your preparation for cross-examination by preparing your final submissions. Mm. So you've got to know where you're heading, at least approximately, before you can start preparing properly for your final hearing, because the final hearing is all about cross-examination and submissions. There's not really much more to it. So if you don't have a case theory by then you won't have any direction for your cross-examination.
Mm. And you're going to do your client a disservice potentially, aren't you?
Well, potentially, yes, because let's face it, you don't cross-examine a witness unless they're unfavourable to your case. The longer you allow an unfavourable witness to sit in the witness box and answer questions, the more likely it is that they're going to say something that's damaging to your case. And so if you don't have a purpose or a direction in your cross-examination, you're just going to be fumbling around cross-examining in the dark or cross-examining without much purpose or aim, and you're going to give that unfavourable witness an opportunity to say something which will not assist your client's case.
Mm. So I think that's helpful when we're going to move on to talk about the next topic, which is just in terms of submissions, because as you said, often advocates will say that the best place to start when you're preparing for a hearing is to know what your final submissions are going to be. Do you have any tips, keeping in mind that this is really aimed at panel practitioners for both parents and children with a variety of levels of experience, but do you have any tips for lawyers when they're writing written submissions?
Short, brief, and the same applies to oral submissions. Clear, simple, succinct, and brief. I can't emphasize that enough. And it sounds easy. Those things sound easy. But I think all lawyers, and particularly advocates, find it difficult to achieve. It's easier to just talk and talk or write and write and hope the point comes through by the end of it. It is much harder to do it succinctly. Mm. So I think that's my absolute top tip for any form of submissions, written or oral: clear, simple, succinct, and brief.
And there's a saying about the judicial pen, isn't there, Karen, in terms of submissions?
As in writing it as if you were...
as if when you see the judicial pen moving...
Oh, right.
Then that means that there's some weight to what you're saying, and perhaps that when the pen stops moving, that's a bit of a sign.
Yeah,
can be.
Oh, look, the judicial nod, I think is even better, but it's not entirely reliable because some judges don't nod and don't do anything during submissions. They're completely poker-faced. But I must say I love the judicial nod because you know that, A, they've heard you, and, B, they hopefully the nod means that they agree with you or they accept what you're saying. So, but, yes, no, the judicial pen, if you see that, it's the same thing during cross-examination, if you see that the judge is no longer writing, then you've probably lost them. At which point you should stop.
Right. So make sure you take your cues from the bench and also be familiar with the judicial officer that you have before you as well.
Always, always.
Okay. Can we talk about affidavit drafting? Have you got any golden rules for affidavit drafting for practitioners? They may be similar to the tips you've got for submissions.
Clarity. I think is really important. Making sure that the words you use are the client's own words, and sometimes they can't be, because clients use certain words that can't be that can't find their way into affidavits. But they must be words the client understands, because ultimately it is the client who will be cross-examined. And it is the client who will be asked questions about the things they've said in their affidavit. And it's never a good look if the client says, "Oh, I didn't say that," or doesn't understand a part of their own affidavit. It really doesn't assist in terms of their credibility. So much as lawyers, we like to take over and to write affidavits the way we would like to write them and use the words we would like to say, it does your client no service to do that for them. It's got to be in words and language that they understand and can answer to. The other thing with drafting affidavits is two things: to draft as if the rules of evidence apply. And that comes back to admissibility and ensuring the best evidence is before the court. Then even though the rules of evidence don't apply, you should still draft an affidavit as if they do apply, because the more admissible the evidence and the better the quality of the evidence, the stronger your case will be. Just because you can get away with hearsay doesn't mean you should file an affidavit full of hearsay, because at the end of the day, the hearsay won't have much weight. Again, it's about putting your client the best foot forward for your client's case. And the other thing is, as I said earlier, drafting an affidavit with a case theory in mind, addressing the issues that are relevant to the case, and making sure that the evidence that is in the affidavit supports the reasons why your client should get what he or she is asking for.
Are there some circumstances where you would think about not filing an affidavit? And look, it's certainly the practice of many magistrates in the Children's Court to allow parents to file at every opportunity. There's certainly no requirement to file. Are there circumstances where you would think really carefully about not filing, and there may be some benefit not to filing? I mean, I certainly used to have a saying with clients that it's better to say that you have done as opposed to I'm going to do something.
So if they haven't actually done the things that they had said they were going to do, or they're expected to do them, then there's not much point in putting on an affidavit saying, "I'm gonna do." Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
So but unless it's something useful and meaningful to say, then don't file.
But I think the other thing is that there are sometimes matters where there might be a fair bit going on in the background for clients. There may unfortunately be some involvement with police. Yep. There may be some real concerns about things that have happened in your client's home. What do you think are some of the considerations for practitioners where there might be an ability to file, but you might want to think twice about it?
Well, that's the example that came to mind when you first asked that question, is if there are criminal proceedings pending, then you have to be very careful about whether you put your client to print, so to speak, in relation to the incidents that are the subject of the criminal proceedings. If they go into print and give their version of what happened in relation to those incidents, then that may or may not, that may well jeopardise their position in the criminal proceedings, because of course in the care proceedings they'd have to be frank and honest about what happened and make admissions that may well be contrary to their interests, whereas in the children's in the criminal jurisdiction that there would be very different considerations. So that's the obvious example that springs to mind for me in terms of where you would be cautious.
And often, as I said, the magistrates will give you the ability to file an affidavit, perhaps in the lead up to the matter being listed for establishment. Mm. If you, and I think we've probably all, or we can all think of examples of this, where affidavits are filed which simply say, you know, I am the mother or the father and I consent to establishment. Is there any benefit to your client in doing that?
No, I don't think so. I really don't. I often see those affidavits, two-page things that say, I'm the mother, I love my child, I want him back in my care, but I consent to establishment. None of that is meaningful evidence, and it's just unnecessary, I think just unnecessary.
Mm. So just sort of, and this might be a good way to flow into the next question, but do you think that that's perhaps a rookie mistake that sometimes people make? Have you got any more sort of no-nos for affidavits, particularly in care matters?
The biggest no-no was not using the client's own words, and I've talked about that already. The other no-no is, and I don't see it that much anymore, it's probably more an old-fashioned thing really, but the practice of responding to someone else's affidavit, so in care proceedings it's usually the secretary, saying, I've read the secretary's affidavit filed on the 18th of March 2021, and I say as follows, in relation to paragraph 1, admit. In relation to paragraph 2, denied. Paragraph 3, admit. And carrying on like that, that kind of affidavit in any jurisdiction, maybe it's common in others, but certainly both care and family law jurisdiction, is of absolutely no assistance and really ought to be avoided. I find affidavits in care proceedings often too brief and not detailed enough. Not detailed enough to be persuasive. I appreciate that there might be a number of reasons for that. There is limited funding. We have clients with limited capacity to give instructions, and often the time frames for affidavits to be produced are very short. So I appreciate all those things mean that often we have very brief and short affidavits. But when it comes to final hearing, I think if you want to run your client's case properly, you need to do the affidavit properly. It needs to be, and that takes time and effort, unfortunately. and particularly with many care clients who have a lot of issues going on, it can be very, very difficult. I appreciate that. But I guess we just need to make the effort to try and, again, it comes back to get the best evidence before the court, have as much detail as possible in relation to relevant issues and events, because otherwise the affidavit material is just not meaningful. And then they get cross-examined about it and they start saying things in the witness box that's not in their affidavit, and no doubt the cross-examiner will say, oh, well, but that's not in your affidavit, you're just making that up. And they may not be making it up. It's just that it hasn't made its way into the affidavit. So that's how we protect our clients, by trying to elicit the evidence from them before the trial, so that it is in their evidence in chief.
And is it right to say that, as you said, the brief affidavit, sometimes that can be problematic? Would you say the same is the case for when sort of broad sweeping statements are made in affidavits, perhaps along the lines of that I deny that event occurred?
Yes.
It would be important in that situation to explain that in more detail. Does your client say that it didn't happen because they weren't there? Or does your client have a different version of events as to what happened?
That's right. That's a good example. Because if they then get in the witness box and try to give an explanation, or set out their, or give their version of what happened, they'll just be, the response will just be, well, why didn't you say that in your affidavit? right? You knew it was a relevant issue. You knew the court was in, that this is one of the reasons why the secretary is saying that the child can't be restored to your care. You had the opportunity to put that evidence before the court and you didn't do it. That's because you're making it up now, or you're not telling the truth, or whatever that might be. Yes. So taking the time to not just find out from your client whether they deny or admit something happened, but taking the time to then ask, well, did something like that happen? Often I find that question really helpful, right? Did something like that happen? Or did you say something like that? Because quite often clients will be very black and white. Not that didn't happen. Well, did something like it happen? Yes, something like that happened.
Or tell me your version of what
happened. That's right. That's right. And then taking the instructions as to what they say happened, so that at least it's there in their evidence in chief, and it's not coming out for the first time under cross-examination.
And of course, the other benefit of doing that is that you can give your client more meaningful advice about their prospects of success, can't you? If you know exactly what you're dealing with, as opposed to just knowing that your client denies it.
Yes. Well, there's three things. There's three benefits of that. Firstly, yes, you can, if you know what the evidence is going to be, then you can give them more meaningful and realistic advice. Secondly, if you know what the evidence is going to be, then you can deal with it. And you can adjust your case theory accordingly, and you can think ahead as to how you're going to manage this piece of evidence if it's not particularly helpful to your case. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, you can control if it's coming out in your client's evidence in chief, in other words, in their affidavit, you can control it better. Or you can control it. Whereas if it's coming out, and when I say control it, I mean control the way it's described and the words that are used, the form in which it comes out. Whereas if it's coming out for the first time in cross-examination, your client's on their own. And you have absolutely no control over what they're going to say in the witness box, which is never a good thing. No. So those are the three advantages of getting in first.
Okay, now I want to move on to the topic of cross-examination, which I think is probably one of the biggest sources of anxiety for practitioners who have to do their own advocacy, particularly those that aren't particularly experienced. The first question I want to ask you, it's important to think through what the purpose of your cross-examination is, and we've sort of touched upon this already. Mm-hmm. You have to focus, don't you, on what you are trying to achieve, and there can be a number of purposes or a number of things that you might be trying to achieve in cross-examination. Can you walk us through what they are?
I think really there's three main reasons why you would cross-examine a witness. Let me go back a step. You only cross-examine a witness if it's absolutely necessary. If it's not absolutely necessary and if there's no reason to do it, then for God's sake, don't do it, because you could easily elicit evidence that doesn't assist your client's case. Okay, so the first thing you need to do is think about, first question you need to ask yourself is, do I need to cross-examine this witness or not? In order to answer that question, you need to think about why you would cross-examine any witness, and you, generally speaking, there's probably only three reasons. Firstly, to get evidence out of that witness to support your case. Okay, so going back to your case theory, what are the reasons why I say that the child should be restored to my client's care? Well, these are the three reasons. What evidence do I need to support those three reasons? Well, I've got evidence from my client. I've got subpoena material from the drug and alcohol counsellor. And I need to get out of this witness, for example, it might be the caseworker or some from the department, I need to get out of them this piece of evidence. Perhaps, for example, that is a bit of a silly example, but contact has been going well. The client's been attending contact regularly. They're always on time. They're always appropriate. The interactions are good and there's been no concerns about contact. Let's say that's the case. And let's assume it's not in the secretary's evidence anywhere else that you can point to. Well, then you need to get that evidence out of the caseworker to support one of your limbs in your case theory. So you would cross-examine the caseworker for that purpose, to elicit that supportive evidence. The second purpose of cross-examination is to undermine or weaken the witness's evidence about something. Okay, so if the caseworker gave evidence about something that doesn't support your client's case or that is damaging to your client's case, and you think you've got a way of weakening or undermining it, then you would cross-examine the caseworker for that reason. The third reason why you would cross-examine is to fulfill the principle or the rule in Brown and Dunn. That's usually not so much of an issue in care proceedings because I don't think the magistrates apply Brown and Dunn strictly. But it is, most people would have heard of the principle in Brown and Dunn. It's a principle essentially of procedural fairness, which basically requires an advocate to put to a witness a proposition or a fact or a version of events to give the witness the opportunity to respond or comment in relation to that proposition or fact or version of events. I don't think it's so much an issue in Brown in care proceedings. But if there's a significant fact that you're going to rely upon in your submissions, then and if it's not, I suppose, obvious from your client's affidavit material, then it's probably prudent to put it to a relevant witness. But I can't think of an example at the moment. But if it's relevant to a particular witness's evidence, and it's something that witness might have a response to, then the procedurally fair thing to do would be to put it to that witness. And so that would be the other purpose of cross-examining them.
Okay. 10 commandments of cross-examination.
This is me plagiarizing a bit. A lot of people might have heard of Irving Younger, Younger. Don't know if he's still alive, actually, but he certainly is or was a very famous advocate in the US. And he developed the 10 commandments of cross-examination in, I think, the 70s or so. And there's some great examples of his lectures on YouTube, which you can watch. But so Irving Younger's 10 commandments were these. 1, be brief. 2, ask short questions using plain words. 3, always ask leading questions. 4, don't ask a question to which you don't know the answer. 5, listen to the witness's answers. 6, don't quarrel. Such an American word, isn't it? Don't quarrel with the witness. 7, don't allow the witness to repeat his direct testimony. In other words, his answers. 8, don't permit the witness to explain his answers. 9, don't ask the one question too many. And 10, save the ultimate point for your submissions. So I love those 10 commandments. They're really simple, and they absolutely encapsulate the rules, the golden rules of cross-examination.
They absolutely do. I just want to pose this question to you with those things in mind. Do you think that they still are just as applicable in the care and protection jurisdiction, focusing when we know we're focusing on what's in the safety, welfare and wellbeing of children? And I guess I'm particularly interested in that for our child representatives, the commandments about not asking questions that you don't know the answer to is one that I'm thinking of.
Yeah, no, they're definitely, these are commandments and rules targeted at people representing parties, obviously, and needing to run a particular case and needing to protect the client's interests and all of that. Different kettle of fish when it comes to being an independent representative, because your role and your duties are very different. I still think you need to be maybe brief, not so much. Well, I mean, Just because you're an independent representative and you have a particular duty to the court doesn't mean you can go on for days and days. You still have to be relevant, and there is a limit to which you can be helpful. And I think that's a tip for young players. I remember as a young child representative and an experienced child representative, I would cross-examine down every rabbit hole that was available to me. was at one point told by a judge that I was loquacious. So it certainly is not a blank check to follow every line of inquiry and go down every rabbit hole. You still need to be focused and limit yourself to what really needs to be done to assist the court. Mm-hmm. So I think being brief is never a bad thing as an advocate. Short questions and plain words absolutely still applies to one. Always asking leading questions. No, as an independent representative, you would ask open questions, and that's part of the, I guess, luxury of being an independent representative, where you can ask those questions that you don't necessarily know the answers to,
and you
genuinely
should.
Because you want to know. And you should genuinely because you want to know the answers and you want to assist the court. Not quarrelling with witnesses, absolutely, that applies to everybody. Allowing witnesses to explain their answers, that's something I think as an independent representative you could be more relaxed about, because it's not your duty to shut witnesses down. I don't think there's the same risk in terms of allowing a witness to explain their answers. That's something you should do because you want the evidence to come out, and there's not as much of a risk in terms of asking one question too many, because there can never be one question too many for an independent representative, and saving the ultimate point for your submissions is I think applicable to everybody. So some of those rules apply to an independent representative, some don't. It is important to bear in mind that your role as an independent representative is very different.
So those are some really, really good tips for child reps. Have you got any other tips for practitioners representing parents in terms of approaching cross-examination? Tips for beginners?
Oh, look, I go back to only do what you need to do. Mm. The temptation when you're preparation is absolute key. You've got to be prepared, particularly when you're inexperienced. You cannot just wing it. Preparation is the key. And it's tempting when you're preparing to think that you've got to cross-examine someone for a long period of time in order to do your job properly, when in fact the most effective cross-examinations are the short and sharp ones, the ones that get quickly to the point and quickly in and quickly out. Because as I said earlier, you don't want to take the risk that the witness will will elicit something from the witness that will damage your own client's case. That would be bad. If somebody else does that, then there's nothing you can do about it. But you don't want to be the one to get something out, to ask a question that results in an answer that actually doesn't help your case. So the short, sharp cross-examination is definitely the more effective one and the safer one.
Notes, structure.
And structure goes to submissions as well, and it all comes back to clarity. Just as you want submissions to be clear and simple, you want your cross-examination to be clear and simple, for two reasons. One, so that the witness can actually understand your question and therefore answer it. There's no point asking a question that the witness can't understand. And secondly, so that the magistrate can follow. Magistrates are very intelligent people, but they're also very tired and pressed for time people. The easier you can make it for them, so the easier and the clearer and simpler the questions, the easier it is for the magistrate to follow. And you want the magistrate to follow because what you're doing in cross-examination is eliciting evidence to either support your case or undermine the other side's case. So if you can make it so that the magistrate can follow you and follow the evidence, then that will assist your case ultimately. So structure does help in terms of, you know, even if it's cross-examination by topics, right? Deal with one topic at a time and make it clear. When you finish with one topic, you're moving on to another. That's a very simple way of structuring your cross-examination to make it clear and easily understood. pace and style, that's something that varies from advocate to advocate, and will, you know, you will, if you're an inexperienced advocate, you will develop your own pace and style. But generally speaking, a slow, gentle and patient style of cross-examination is more effective than the table thumping machine gun style of cross-examination
that we might see on TV.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. But to be slow and gentle and patient, it comes back to you need to know where you're going, and that's why having the case theory and a direction is so important.
Okay, some really, really good tips there for those that might be new or about to embark on some advocacy. Have you got any references or reading materials that you think people should have a look at if they're wanting to learn more about advocacy?
Look, the fundamental rules of advocacy are really, actually really basic, and every advocacy course you do, if you do a course with the Advocacy Institute of Australia, it'll be the same things over and over again. It'll be about case theory. It'll be about brevity, clarity, simplicity, all those things. It's the same rules. So they're not difficult rules, but they are, as I said earlier, they are hard to put into practice, and so it doesn't hurt, no matter how experienced as an advocate you are, to keep coming back to those basics. And so any sort of, as I said, I love Irvin Younger's really basic, you know, 10 commandments. And I would commend his YouTube videos if you're interested in particularly in cross-examination, but also I think Hampel, H-A-M-P-E-L, has an advocacy manual that's fairly old, but the rules don't date. The Advocacy Institute also has some publications on their website, and they also have a book, I think, which might be helpful as well. But you will find any good advocacy text or resource it will have the same basic rules. It's just about being able to do it.
Okay, some very good advice though. Really, it's remember to keep it simple in the sense of refer back to those basics, and that will hold you in good stead.
That's right.
Thank you very much for joining me, Karen.
You're welcome. Pleasure.